When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I am Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Reese.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. How's it going, Paul?
I feel fine.
Yeah, very good.
Yes.
What's not to feel fine about?
Exactly. Okay, so listeners, in case you're curious to set this in a period in time, we are recording just a few days before Inauguration Day in 2025. So I don't know. Maybe we'll have another episode after this. Maybe we won't. Who knows? And just a little heads up to everybody for sound quality. I am currently in Denver, Colorado, and it is 5 degrees. So I have my heater cranked. If you hear a whirring noise in the background, I apologize for that. But
I am currently in Chicago, and we are about to hit -5 degrees. So my heater also.
So if there's a buzzing noise in the background, sorry, but we got to stay warm.
It's one of the two of us. Just the two of us.
Okay, so today on the program, we are going to be discussing a really good comic book, if I give some spoilers. It's Catwoman, Selina's Big Score by Darwin Cook, and some sundry issues on the back end. Do you have anything you want to say initially for this?
Not that initially. We'll figure it out. You know, it'll be clear.
Okay.
Anybody who's familiar with the source material will know who we're talking about and probably guess what the supplemental stuff will also be about. Or they'll find out.
Yeah. Or, you know, keep listening because, you know, we'll get to it. So I think we're rambling because the first thing we're going to talk about is something I don't want to talk about.
We're in avoidance.
Yes. It's something I find incredibly distasteful and upsetting, but it has to be talked about because we are a comic book podcast. And that is, of course, the situation with Neil Gaiman. Now, Neil Gaiman has been accused of misconduct, and it's kind of disturbing. What are your initial thoughts on this, Brian?
So, I mean, I really don't. We've avoided this for about 6 months or so, I think, because we didn't want to.
Right.
And we don't want these podcasts to be heavy. We're goofy older dudes who do goofy stuff and talk about our lunches.
Yes.
Some of these allegations surfaced 6, 7, 8 months ago.
Right.
And I think there was a period where a lot of us were disappointed, but waiting for essentially another shoe to drop. A whole bunch of shoes dropped, like a shoe store dropped.
Yeah.
And this week. And it was a Vulture article, actually got the front page. The accusations that had been out there were fleshed out and added to and compounded in ways that just are horrifying. And it's hard because there's the innocence until proven. And I understand that, but there's also the believe women, and that's important.
Yes.
I think that article is hard to read. I don't know if I recommend it. The detail it goes into is really, really difficult to read through.
I will admit I didn't finish it. I got about halfway through the article and I said, I can't read this anymore. I have to stop.
I made myself finish it. Gaiman replied, probably against his PR people's wishes, where he seemed to not deny, but double down.
He seems to believe that what he's doing is perfectly fine. And, you know, it's just, he seems to believe that what he's doing is a normal thing and it's consensual. It is quite obvious that it is not consensual.
Accusers seem to suggest not consensual.
This is another example of a man with power who takes advantage of that in the most horrifying ways. This is, like I said, disappointing. I mean, I don't want to make it about, you know, Gaiman's one of my all-time favorite creators.
Same here, and I think for a lot of people.
I have cited him in the past as being an inspiration for what because I write, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to create things, and I use him as an example of how to do it correctly. And my God,
and
I don't have words for it. It's awful.
It's hard. And this is, I think, why we've avoided talking about it. But I think we have to acknowledge it.
Yeah.
That this is out there. And we can't just be like, there's a certain very famous comic book website who has not remotely acknowledged any of this. And it's a website that prides itself on investigative reporting. And I think that is strange to not even acknowledge.
You could say it's not cool.
It's not cool.
Yeah.
What someone gets up to in their personal life behind closed doors in legal, consensual ways is none of my damn business.
But when it becomes abuse.
When the potential of it being abuse comes out and it is a creator or someone that I have amazing affection for as a creator, not as a person, I don't know Neil Gaiman. In terms of a person who has shaped, like you said, as you as a writer, me as a writer, me as a fan of like deconstruction and archetype, and it's extremely upsetting. And nobody owes me anything about being upset. I get to be upset, and nobody else has to be upset with me. But at this point in all of this, I am upset and sort of at odds with, you know, kill your idols, right?
Right.
Don't have heroes. Maybe Gail Simone gets to be a hero, but nobody else. I don't know.
Well, no, don't. don't blame us for having heroes. Blame the fucking people who, you know, just be a decent person. It's not that fucking hard. Sorry to use the language, but just don't be an asshole. Yeah. Why is that such a difficulty in this culture that we live in today? Just don't be an asshole. Treat people with respect and dignity that they deserve, for God's sakes.
And we don't know how this is all going to shake out. We don't know where this leads. There may not be legal consequences to this. I've read various things. I'm not an expert in the law, so I don't know. It feels like when you have, it's like cockroaches, right? You see one, there's 100. So who can tell? But I feel like we needed to at least acknowledge we are aware of this, and we are not trying to ignore it because we want to stick our fingers in our ears and pretend like this is going to go away and this doesn't exist. It exists. It's out there, and we need to we are saying we know this, and we are expressing very strong opinions.
Yes.
Yeah. So
it just needs to be acknowledged because Gaiman is one of the most prominent, most acclaimed comic book creators in the history of the medium. I mean, he is on the top of the pantheon. We have sung his praises in the past. We've covered a couple of his comics, three of his comics, actually. Yeah, and it's just, we have to acknowledge the fact that we know this is out there. And I, for one, say it's not okay. And
if you are out there and you're reading these and you are triggered by these things, that is okay. You can be, you know, it's feel everything that you should feel on the matter, and you are okay to feel those things.
Yeah.
And to have these reactions to it, because I'm having them, and it's not good what he has done or allegedly done.
You know what? Screw that. Screw that. Fuck Neil Gaiman, basically.
Well, he kind of acknowledged that he did these things. So
yeah.
He just doesn't think he did anything.
I hate to say that. It's gotten to the point where fuck Neil Gaiman. All right. Let's move on to something better.
Let's go for joy.
So about a week and a half ago at the time of this recording, the final episode of the first season of Creature Commandos ended. Creature Commandos being the animated series written and created by James Gunn, part of the new DC extended media world film universe thing, whatever they're calling it these days. We had talked about the first few episodes and we liked it. Brian, how did you feel about how this series concluded?
It was great. I mean,
yeah. I thought you were going to say, no, it sucked. but okay, good.
Killing mermaid woman
Nina, yeah,
Nina, felt a little
gratuitous.
There are phrases for that, you know, because G.I. Robot gets revived at
figuring
the end.
Better than ever,
yeah. But
I have a feeling that, I mean, this is a comic book universe. I have a feeling Nina will come back because she's the heart of the team.
Like, literally kind of the moral center.
Exactly.
Although, you know, I mean, the whole series was fun and everything about it was great. I didn't love the depiction of Frankenstein. I think it's because I like Frankenstein as the character from Morrison's Seven Soldiers.
Seven Soldiers, I was going to say.
And also Frankenstein and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., a series that nobody probably remember, very few people remember except me, but wow, that was fun. I think Doug Mankey did the art on it. It was so good. And I like that iteration of Frankenstein, but James Gunn doesn't owe me my favorite version of Frankenstein.
James Gunn likes to take characters and mold them into different iterations.
Right.
You know, because none of the characters, with the exception of maybe Weasel, are comic book accurate. He changes them to fit the story he's telling.
Sure. And that's good. It's good to, when you're doing film, remove from the expected, you know, sort of comic book idea. I mean, Marvel did that with lots of their characters and the MCU. Right. But I really, really, really enjoyed. I love Lady Frankenstein as a complete and utter badass.
Yes. But everyone, each episode focused on a character-centric and gave you their backstories. And like the story of Dr. Phosphorus was tragic. Weasel, I've never it's felt as
tragic.
I know, I've never felt so sympathetic towards a weasel man.
Weasel did nothing wrong.
Right.
He even tried to save the princess in the end.
He's the best character. He's the nicest, most moral character of them all.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm very sad for Weasel. He should have stayed with the wolves.
Yes. He was so happy.
He was so happy.
And he taught them how to play fetch.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, and was so accepted nice. Into the pack.
It's so sad.
It is.
But that's the thing with James Gunn is he takes these incredibly silly, and let's face it, stupid scenarios, and he infuses it with this tragic, melancholic strain. And it's really nice. I mean,
yeah.
I really love how he molds a story. And I have to say his humor. Okay, so there's one example of his humor that epitomized it for me. So Clayface is impersonating a professor, a college professor.
Mm-hmm.
And she's talking about Themyscira. And all he wants to talk about is the lesbians. And Frankenstein just looks and goes, well, that seems unprofessional. It's so understated and funny. I love the way James Gunn crafts a story, and I love his humor. Yeah.
It is interesting to see how they, and maybe they're not even bothering to try, because, you know, obviously Clayface in the Harley Quinn show is vastly different than the Clayface in James Gunn's show. And part of me is kind of hoping they just leave Harley Quinn alone and let Harley Quinn and her series do whatever they want without having to, like, come into James Gunn's DC universe. I feel like they're very separate things. And, you know, the new Harley Quinn just dropped. The first episode dropped last night or this past week. And it's still what it is. And it's still kooky crazy.
And I think it's, you know, that's perfect, especially for DC, having different separate universes to tell different aspects of characters and different stories.
Right.
That's kind of in their raison d'etre.
Yeah.
You know? So that's, so that seems perfectly fine. Let Harley Quinn be Harley Quinn. And then the DCEU film universe will just be its own thing. And that's cool. You know, I think because Robert Pattinson's Batman is going to continue.
Yeah.
But I find it hard to believe he's going to be, you know, folded into what he's doing, what James Gunn is doing.
Right. Because the Batman we saw in Creature Commandos is thick.
Yes. And, you know, there's going to be the
Batman.
Yeah. Because there's going to be a Brave and the Bold series with Damian Wayne. Yeah. So I, like I said, find it really hard to believe that that would be Robert Pattinson's, you know, crying in the rain Batman, which is fine. You know, you can have two versions and, you know, it's okay.
None of it has to be canon.
And to get back to what we talked about on the last episode where James Gunn gave that interview where everything is canon until it isn't anymore, which is great. I think that's a great attitude to have. Don't let canonicity stifle your creativity, you know.
Right.
If you got a story to tell, tell it.
Tell the story. Yeah.
And if it contradicts canon, so be it. Doesn't matter. This is all made up and we make the rules. Hang on. Let me get down off of that soapbox. There we go. So anyway, the series, I really liked it. Yes, to reiterate what you said, killing Nina was somebody had to die.
Right.
And the most impactful character was Nina because she was the sweet, sad little girl. But I have a feeling she'll be back. She's too nice to not come back.
She's too nice.
And you can do some hand wavy. She was genetically engineered so she can come back. It's all good. So Creature Commandos, good.
Yes.
I'm really looking forward to, I think we talked about this last time too. My belief is that James Gunn is setting up all these kind of paramilitary organizations and setting up a world where there are superheroes, but they're not exactly great. They're morally ambiguous because that's what, you know, Suicide Squad, Creature Commandos, Peacemaker, all of the people in that are questionable in their morality. But we have Superman coming.
Well, and the fact that it's Superman that's going to be the first one out.
Right.
Like,
so it's because
it creates this like sort of morally questionable world. Right. So at some point there has to be that.
The moral center.
The moral center and or the shining beacon on the hill.
Exactly.
Right. And exactly. So, you know, I don't necessarily feel like Superman needs to be made into a morally questionable character. And I suspect, I'm hoping that Gunn doesn't do that. Superman is hard to deal with. Because he's the Boy Scout, you know. And so how do you deal with that if Superman then is just grim and gritty like Suicide Squad, Peacemaker, Creature Commandos, then it becomes one note.
Exactly. And Superman, as being the, you know, the Boy Scout, the one who always does the right thing, people say that's boring. I disagree with that because the story conflict comes from he always does the right thing, but he can't save everybody.
Right.
And so he has to decide, you know, who do I save and deal with the moral implications of that.
Right.
Exactly. So I would love for the new movie, and it all remains to be seen at this point. I would love to see Superman be the beacon on the hill and change this morally ambiguous world that Gunn has already created and kind of turn people and you know, make him be the one that people look to as
you
an
need,
example.
You need contrast. If everything is shades of gray, that's not interesting. You need the darkness and the light in between the shades of gray to sort of eat, like that's where the good conflict comes from, as opposed to just a middling conflict of gravy gray.
Exactly. So on that note, let's go to a story about a morally ambiguous group of people. Yeah, let's take a little break and we'll come back and talk about Selena's big score. We're back, Brian. Today on the program, we're discussing your selection. Can you tell us all about it?
I can. I will. I shall. Donald Westlake was born on July 12, 1933, in New York. An obsessive writer, even in his teens, Westlake received over 200 rejections for his work before finally selling a short story in 1954. Sporadic sales followed. After serving in the Air Force for 2 years, Westlake moved to New York City to work for a literary agency. By 1960, though, he finally had his first novel, The Mercenaries, published, and he never looked back. Westlake published over 100 novels along with dozens of short stories before his death in 2008. Along the way, he won 3 Edgar Awards and was inducted as a Mystery Writers of America Grand Master in 1993. This is one of the highest honors a writer in a genre can ever receive. It was well earned. He also wrote the screenplay for The Grifters, among others. Westlake remains one of the most revered authors in the crime genre, justifiably. His primary expertise and thrust, thematically, is the heist novel. Nobody did it better. Westlake had 2 very notable character creations, each taking up the bulk of his writings. The first is John Dortmunder, a more humorous and lighthearted protagonist, for whom each heist or burglary goes horribly wrong with hilarious but not inconsequential results. Dortmunder is generally nonviolent. And writing under the pseudonym Richard Stark, Westlake created one of the most iconic characters in all American literature. Parker, just Parker, for 24 novels. A completely amoral, emotionless machine of violence and expediency, Parker is the cool, the criminal with a personal code who would kill without thinking, especially if you betrayed or double-crossed him. A stone amongst the bubbling brook of crime and violence around him. And after seeing Lee Marvin portray him in the 1967 film Point Blank, I can never picture him as anything other than Marvin. It fits. And Darwin Cook agreed with me. Perhaps Ed Brubaker as well. Both Darwin Cook and Ed Brubaker have clearly shown a great love for Stark's novels. Brubaker's writing style has always echoed the hard-boiled crime ethos of Stark. And Darwin Cook has written and drawn blatant love letters to not only the themes and ethical ambivalence of the genre, but to the visual and toned look of the 50s, 60s, and 70s noir. Cook went so far as to adapt 4 of the Parker novels into comics form for IDW before his death. Which leads us to Catwoman. Tapped to relaunch the Catwoman series in 2001, Brubaker and Cook worked together to create a prequel of sorts before the proper series began. Beginning with Cook's long-form Selena's Big Score mini and buffered by Brubaker and Cook's backup stories in Detective Comics issues 759 to 167, the pair radically reinvented the character and added a gritty, but not grim, street-level aspect to the character. It's almost as if they took the original Batman concept, the street-level detective, rather than the blunt force reactor to monsters, and play Selina Kyle into the active. Selina Big Score is a heist masterpiece. Written and drawn by Cook, it is, on its surface, a procedural, with a target, a plan, and an execution. But Cook does very interesting things. In 4 parts, each segment is done in a separate narrative style and a differing perspective. The basis is easy, again, a heist. But each issue reflects a variance, and the visuals are Cook at his finest. The backups from Detective Comics, which run concurrently, are our introduction to the partnership of Cook and Brubaker. But they are writ small, focusing in the work of Slam Bradley, aka Robert Mitchum. It's gumshoe stuff. Extremely violent, but procedural. Detective Comics indeed. It's a thrill to watch Brubaker and Cook work together on these, and the knowledge that they only had a few issues of the subsequent Catwoman series together is kind of sad. They were the perfect match. Cook left us far too soon, but he left an enduring legacy of amazing comics to read and read again. Selina's Big Score and his brief work with fellow traveler Brubaker certainly stands among some of the best. So, Paul, I recommended this. You read it. Thoughts and feelings, prayers?
I don't know, Brian. I don't think it's all that good. My kid, it's amazing. I love it. No, this is really great. Oh, man. First of all, it looks magnificent. You know, Darwin Cook just has that. It's a beautiful style. It's cartoonish, but elegant.
Yeah.
Yeah. His use of light and shadow is gorgeous. And the way things are silhouetted. Yeah. Silhouetted? Silhouetted.
Silhouetted.
Silhouetted. Silhouetted. Yeah, it's beautiful stuff. But the story itself, you are much more the expert on, obviously, just from that introduction, you are obviously the expert on noir and crime stories in general, much more so than I am. But I love a good heist, and this is a good heist.
It is.
God, what you're so right about the partnership between Cook and Brubaker. They worked so well together.
We were robbed.
Yes, we were.
It was a heist. We were robbed.
That's right. I loved your line there in the introduction. Detective Comics, indeed. This is great. You know, yeah.
I mean, pulp crime is such an amazing genre. I mean, it you have some of the big names, you know, in Daniel Woodrow and Chandler and Jim Thompson, three writers who were nothing alike in any way, shape, or form.
No.
Often considered kind of the big three. I mean, you could put Woolrich in there. I mean, there's a million writers you could put in there, and there's a million writers who are smaller in all of this. But Westlake certainly is such a giant among them, and Stark is such a giant character in the entire genre, which shouldn't just be called a genre because it's so different from writer to writer. But Stark looms so large mm-hmm. in Darwin Cook's work.
And that's fairly obvious just from the name of one of the characters. You could say his artwork has a stark contrast.
It does, yes. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. I'll be here all week. Really good stuff. I didn't know that he adapted Parker stories for IDW.
Yes.
So I am going to have to track those down.
There are... I had to research because I couldn't remember to make sure I had the right amount, but it was four.
Yeah, no, I'm going to have to track those down. That's what I'll be doing as soon as we finish recording. But yeah, let's get to this wonderful story.
So what I want to do is that there's a contrast between... So there's Selena's big score.
Mm-hmm.
I initially recommended this whole collection, and I realized it was Selena's big score, the four shorter backups from Detective Comics. Then there's the first four issues of the Catwoman series, which are done by Brubaker and Cook. And then there's nine issues, that are Brubaker continuing on after Cook left. And then Cameron Stewart does some great work in those too. But it was unwieldy to talk about all of that.
Exactly. I mean, just Selena's big score in and of itself is plenty to talk about.
So. Yeah. I mean, it's not complex. I mean, it's complex in the way any good crime story unfolds. And what's one of the great things about it, but really hard to take notes about when I'm trying to like figure out how to talk about this, is the constant flashbacks and how to wrap these in. And then the question I had was, I have to talk about Selena's big score, but the four Detective Comic backups, which are Brubaker and Cook, are run concurrently with the bigger story, but the backups are all about Slam Bradley. And we should talk about Slam Bradley quickly before we go into this, because Slam Bradley is such a big part of the Catwoman, the Brubaker Catwoman story.
Yeah, the hard-boiled detective. If you've read anything by Brubaker, he loves the hard-boiled detective, you know, the grizzled old man.
Yeah. And Cook loves the actual amoral criminal, and Brubaker loves the hard-boiled detective.
Which is a great combination.
Which is a great combination, because you see with Brubaker his love for, let's be honest, again, visually, I alluded to this, the character Stark is presented visually as Lee Marvin. And Slam Bradley is presented visually as Robert Mitchum. It's not even confusing. You look at those two characters and you're like, those are two of the greatest actors we've had walk across the screen in the 50s, 60s, 70s, what have you. But Slam Bradley, what is interesting in this, before we get into the story itself, you know, Slam Bradley was featured in Detective Comics number one.
Oh. Way back when. I did not.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I knew that, but I didn't put it together. Yeah.
So for historical context, Slam Bradley, those early issues of Detective Comics focused on Slam Bradley. They were extremely, extremely, extremely racist.
It was a different time, Brian.
Well, it sure as heck was, and particularly involving the Yellow Peril.
Yes, that was a big thing back then, wasn't it?
That was a big thing. Nobody came out of that time period safe from engaging in that. So Slam Bradley is one of the very early DC comic characters. As you can imagine, that character fell out of favor for a long period of time.
And again, this gets back to both Darwyn Cook and Brubaker. They are incredibly good at retconning and reviving old characters. I mean, just look what Brubaker did with Bucky
Right.
and some of the old, some of the old Captain America stories, not exactly PC back in the day.
Yeah, the same
But
issue.
yeah, same issues. And Brubaker was a master at pulling those and making them relevant again. And Darwyn Cook is incredibly good at that as well.
And that's kind of the point. They rescued Slam Bradley from this sort of sketchy past and sort of being ignored. He made random appearances throughout DC history, but it was Brubaker in particular. I mean, Darwyn Cook and Brubaker to have been behind the scenes when these two cats were talking about putting all of this together would have been amazing. I mean, can you imagine these two guys just spitballing all of these ideas that they had? It boggles the mind. So the two of them working together, and I think probably I don't want to take away credit from one to give the other, but again, because Cook loves the criminal and Brubaker loves the PI, who knows who had the stronger voice? But the fact that those two cats rehabbed Slam Bradley into this incredibly interesting character that
And nuanced. Yeah.
nuanced,
Yeah.
who lasted after his introduction in Catwoman. He was a regular player in Catwoman for decades after this. Well, decades, I mean, this is 2001. I mean, we're not talking decades, but he became like an important part of the narrative, the Catwoman narrative.
And let me just say, Brian, it's been almost 25 years. So it's
Okay,
that this
so decades.
Yeah, decades. It's been a while. It always
Decades.
surprises me
I was gonna
how
ask
time
you.
moves on.
I want to point this out before we hit the story because I don't want to like stop everything when we're talking to the story to talk about what they did with Slam Bradley. To me, it's very really important to see what they did with Slam Bradley and how they moved this particular character forward from a rather dubious past.
Masterful.
Yeah.
And the one thing I want to just point out again before we begin into the actual story is this is a Catwoman story, but Catwoman is referenced almost not at all, which I find really fascinating that Darwyn Cook chose that. I mean, Selina is Catwoman, obviously.
Selena's Catwoman.
But
Right, but it's a Selena story. It's not a Catwoman story.
exactly.
It
Yeah.
becomes Catwoman when it becomes Catwoman. But there's
Exactly.
a reason, right, as you said, it's called Selena's Big Score.
Yeah, not Catwoman's big score. Yeah.
The story itself is, again, it's a heist story. We start with Selena needs money. We find out, and like there is some history we need to know. So Selena is dead and Catwoman is dead.
So far as
Now, I
everybody
didn't,
knows, yeah.
as far as everybody knows, right? So I didn't go back and reread all of the previous stuff that led to this. What we know is that at some point, Catwoman killed Selina Kyle, who was running for mayor of New York.
Yeah, I didn't go back to read any of that too, but I did
Right.
read sort of a synopsis and went, huh, Mayor of New York. There you
I
go.
kind of know, I know a little bit about it, but I didn't read back enough to like be able to go. It's in my knowledge of the DC history. It is not in my knowledge of being able to like discuss backstory for our purposes here, because nobody cares.
Yes.
So Catwoman killed Selina Kyle, and then at some point, Catwoman is killed. So both Catwoman and Selina Kyle are dead.
With quotes, they're dead.
Right. Clearly not.
Exactly.
So we start off with this. So we start off in Morocco
Yeah.
with Selina Kyle stealing an artifact and an incredible action sequence. Again, Darwyn Cook, Darwyn Cook, Darwyn Cook, Darwyn Cook. Just a master of motion and just Wow.
Yeah, through the streets of Morocco and on the rooftops. Again, masterful light and shadow. The coloring in this is muted, but really dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yellows.
Yellows and purples and blues.
Talk about yellows, because
yes.
Yellows are extremely prominent throughout this. Every sign is in yellow. Did you catch it? Like all of the shops, Swifties is in yellow, the diner is in yellow, and all of them are kind of shaped almost in an oval, a yellow with yellow and black.
Interesting.
Yes.
I don't see the connection.
That's Batman's.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Okay.
Like, I'm sorry. I'm being a jerk. I will help be more obvious in the future.
How wonderfully subtle. But anyway, so we start off, it's like, it's just Catwoman. Catwoman needs money, so she steals an artifact. There's an amazing action sequence that goes on for pages and pages and pages, which leads her in like a well where she's hiding in a well and basically says, if this were Gotham, I'd never get away with that because of him. We all know who him is, but she gets away with it. But then she finds out that the artifact is a fake. So she still needs money.
So she has to go back to the only place where she knows she has contacts and can rustle up some cash.
So back to Gotham.
Back to Gotham it is.
And she ends up at Swifty's.
Poor old Swifty.
Or Burgess Meredith. So she ends up at Burgess or Swifty's pawn shop, where she gets like a little package she had left. And she's like, oh, it's only $10,000, so it's walking around money. Personally, I'd be good with $10,000 walking around money, but that's just me. Selina has higher taste than I do.
Apparently. She's an elegant woman, Brian.
She is an elegant woman. But she basically tells Swifty, I need more. I need, you know, she's asking him, where's the action?
Yeah.
She wants to know where the action is. I mean, again, this is your hard-boiled crime heist novel. It's like every criminal who is part of a gang of heists, you know, because, you know, it's heists are different than other types of crime novels. And so you have groups of people who are just looking for the next score.
Yeah, need a piece of the action.
Your next big score. So Swifty basically says there is a big thing going down. But Swifty's not sure if she's up for it. And she's like, well, let's talk about it. Bring in the person who is like putting the feelers out. So Selina ends up meeting with Chantel or Pam Grier, depending on who. This is Darwin Cook. They're all over the place.
Yeah. Chantel is the only character I feel was, how do you put it, done dirty in this.
He was done dirty.
Yeah. She's a good character, but she's pretty much there to be the tragic figure to give Selina the motivation to continue.
I wouldn't necessarily call it fridging, but there's some fridging aspects.
It's a little chilly, let's just say.
Yeah, it's a little chilly.
And the fact that she's a person of color is problematic. But
yes.
That's actually the only thing the only real criticism I have of this is the way the character of Chantel was depicted and what her consequences are.
But at the end of the day, this genre has never been nice to women.
No, no.
Ever. It's just hasn't been. And that always has to be a thing acknowledged within the genre that Cook and Brubaker are working in. It will always be a thing because it's always existed as a thing. Yeah. So,
and I do, in defense of Cook and Brubaker, they both do. I mean, we're looking at Selina is the protagonist of this story.
Exactly.
And she's an incredibly strong and you know, talented woman. And Brubaker looked with Velvet and right. other things. So,
and they switch it up. And it definitely is switched up with Selina being the prime, which is great.
Yeah.
So Chantel tells the story. What she has is, and of course it's a Falcone, because it's always a Falcone in Gotham.
Yeah. How many are there? How many Falcones are there?
They keep coming back, and apparently they're going to be back again in a few months with Hush. But Chantel is a liaison of
an escort.
One of the Falcone capos, Frank Falcone. And Chantel is kind of treated as furniture dressing. Falcone talks freely in front of her with his other cohort. So Chantel has found out that there is a $24 million payment going out for a shit ton of heroin that's going to happen up north on the border, the Canadian-American border.
Well, that is until Canada becomes a state.
Until, yes, Canada is one of us, along with Greenland. And so Selena's like, she's like, I'm all in on this. Let's figure out how to rob this train of the $24 million. That's yes. a lot of money. Even 25 years ago, that's a lot of money.
Exactly. And I love the fact that it's on a train, because trains are the best way to do a heist, in my personal opinion. I love a train heist.
But a train heist is awesome.
Yes.
I'm assuming you're not joking.
No, I am not joking. I am. Yes. I am 100% on board. I'm on board the train.
You're on board the train. And so it's so Selena's on board. But what she also knows is that she can't do this alone. She needs help.
And there's only one guy who's tough enough to get it done.
And Stark.
Stark.
Who, apparently, her history with, not great.
No.
It was great. Like, really great. Like, bow, chicka, bow, bow, great.
But their relationship had a very...
But something happened.
Something bad happened.
Something bad happened. Maybe we'll find out about it later on. And Swifty, of course, is like, you sure about this? You know, I mean, you know, are you sure you want to bring Stark in? And Selena's like, he's the only one who can coordinate a heist this size. So she tells Swifty to schedule it. Contact yes. Stark, see if he'll meet her. So that's so pretty much the end of the first. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, so that leads us to book two, which is done from, which is from Stark's perspective. And we head on down to Miami Beach.
And I do want to point out that I've referenced this before, but I do want to clarify. So what is interesting about these four, this is separated into four separate bits. And so this the next issue is titled Stark, and it is from Stark's point of view. And what I think is really interesting is, so the first issue is from Selena's point of view. The second issue is from Stark's point of view. The third issue, I'm going to give it away, is from Slam Bradley's point of view. And the fourth issue is back to Selena, but it also mixes in all three of the others. So it's narratively, even linguistically, in this one, when we get Stark's point of view, Stark is narrating this for the most part, although it goes off from the narration to fill in other parts of the story. Linguistically, it's like, the way Cook writes, say, Selena's dialogue or Selena's internal thoughts, Stark's internal thoughts, Slam Bradley's internal thoughts, and then back to Selena's internal thoughts, they are written mirroring the different types of crime genres that exist out there.
So we're down in Miami.
So, because, of course, we're down in Miami.
Every criminal eventually makes his way to Miami.
Right. And so Selena meets up with Parker. I'm sorry, with Stark. Parker, Stark. They're all the same, right? So Selena meets, they meet up. They meet cute. They don't meet cute. It's not cute. And she basically lays it out to him. You know, they're on the beach. Yeah. And we get, you know, Stark's sort of, again, this is from Stark's point of view. So he's talking about how he distrusts her.
Well, and then, so we get this, and this kind of sets the stage for their relationship. Where she says, I need your help, but I thought I didn't want to come here because I thought you might kill me. And he says, yeah, if I was going to kill you, you'd be dead.
Right.
So so that sets the stage of, okay, this is where this relationship is right now. And then we get a little bit of the backstory of how Stark and Selena came to be involved with one another.
Yeah. So Selena and Stark meet up and they discuss it. And there's a whole bunch of flashbacks and all kinds of things going on where their history is discussed and sort of explicated. Some of this is going to be out of order for the from the actual comic, but essentially, Selena and Stark met up. I'm just going to like lay it all out, and we'll
absolutely. You
know. So Selena and Stark met up. Selena was working as woman of the night.
She was a high-priced escort,
probably a dominatrix.
Not probably.
Yeah. But I think that's an interesting distinction, and that may have been a DC thing. She was a dom.
She was not a prostitute. She was
right. There was no sexual contact.
There you go. Yeah.
And I think that's a very interesting distinction that was very intentionally made. At some point, she had a client, and Stark shows up and kills her client. And she's like, the hell you're doing? Who the hell are you? And there's a, he's just like, there's like a really strong sexual tension created between the two of them. And eventually he takes her under his wing.
Yeah, and this is where it gets a little bit creepy. And I don't know, because he's kind of a mentor, almost father figure to her, but they also begin a romantic relationship.
Right.
Because let's say Stark's significantly older than Selena. So yeah, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I don't think this is like, I think this is intent the this is intentional,
Yes.
this weirdness is intentional between the two of them.
And so what is then intimated in this is that they did a burglary together or a heist or what have you. She talks him into stealing from the mob, which he has very intentionally not done, because it's some dialogue earlier says he always left the mob alone and the mob left him alone. So against his better instincts, Selena talks him into stealing from the mob, a diamond heist.
Which, for the most part, goes really well.
Right.
Yeah.
Until the end, which isn't revealed until later issues, but we could talk about it now if you want. This issue is where things bog down.
Exactly.
And then we just shoot straight on till dawn. So,
Well, this is the issue where the pieces are being put in place. The team
right.
is being assembled. The first book, I guess, book one, Selena, is where Selena decides this is what's going to happen. She figures out what the score is going to be.
Right.
Book two, this is putting the team together, getting a plan in place.
Yes.
So we have Selena hooking up with Swifty. Not hooking up with Swifty, that's the wrong terminology. She gets Swifty on board, heads to Stark. Against his better judgment, he decides to help her.
Eventually, she talks him into helping her, and
Yeah.
we get like we said, we get a lot of like kind of backstory, and we understand that there's like previous relationship and existing relationship. There was a betrayal somewhere along the line, and Stark eventually comes around and agrees to help her.
So they head off to Las Vegas to get another member of the team. The guy who's going to have it's basically the weapons and the materials.
In the meantime, before they start that, Stark tells her, he's like, hey, because he looked into her and he's like, hey, you need to go take care of something back in Gotham. Because according to Swifty, there's some private eye looking into her life. And so, he's like, let's figure this out. We're going to do this, but you need to go back to Gotham to take care of something else right now. And so Selina returns to Gotham, and we find out later what happens. But for now, 4 days later, we're in Vegas.
So who would this character be an
Jeff.
equivalent to? Jeff. Well, I know Jeff, but what would
I
Jeff?
have no idea. I don't know who Jeff is.
Okay.
I don't know who Jeff is.
Jeff's just sort of the young up and comer.
I didn't see like an equivalent. I can think of a few, but none of them really match, so I'm not gonna.
So maybe he's sort of a Brad Pitt or
Yeah,
I'm thinking of the Ocean's 11, the recent one,
right, yeah,
not the
no.
original, not the original.
Because the
Maybe.
original is untouchable.
Yeah, so maybe he's Brad Pitt or Clooney, something like that.
And Jeff is the he's the ordnance guy.
He got the stuff.
He's got the stuff. And it's a great scene where they show up in a casino. So of course they show up, and of course Jeff like reacts like he holds a gun to them and says, "What are you doing bothering me here?" It's loses his shit and tells them to get the hell out. And Selena's like, "What the hell, Stark?" And then a few hours later, they're in a bar, and in comes Jeff, and it turns out he was just protecting his cover because there were mob guys there.
Yeah, and he doesn't want to be associated with Stark, or want to make it seem as if he's being associated with Stark.
Yeah, so they basically, sell him on the heist, and he's all in. So the rest of it, the rest of this particular issue is it's just them plotting. And they come up with, I mean, it's a great sequence. It's not really germane. I mean, people could read this for themselves. It's like they're setting up how to like way to like hook up with the train. They're setting up a genius way to like get the money, which is Selena's idea, which is to wrap them all in these like inflatable kind of rafts, Right, and then drop the money off the train into the water, and then the money will float. It's a long bit of heist planning.
Exactly. Like
And
they put the team in place, and now it's, now we work out the details. We have to have every detail precisely calculated so it can't go wrong, and now we know what will go wrong.
the plan always goes wrong.
Right.
But I mean, the rest of it is it's again, the details don't really matter. They're more fun to be read than me to than us to describe them. All three of them are brilliant at what they're planning.
But then we have, so Selina has to get back to Gotham. And then we have Stark and Jeff have a little conversation, and Stark lays it out. Do not trust her. I know from past experience. Don't. And there's actually a nice little interesting scene where they're having this discussion of don't trust her, and a cat runs by, and he's like,
Yeah.
"Oh, yeah, well, that's ironic, isn't
Right.
it?"
It's I mean, it's a funny scene. Eventually, yes, so they have this discussion, and then we go back to Gotham at the end of this issue. Chantel has been discovered by Falcone to have been sending this information, like the information about the train schedule and all of the plans for the transportation of the heroine and the exchange of the money. She's been sending it from Falcone's personal email.
Probably shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Falcone has found out.
With obvious consequences, as we've discussed in the beginning.
So, I mean, the consequences play out in a more graphic manner in the next issue. Issue two is like the most complex. There's a lot of things going on. We've glossed over numerous of those. But we hit issue three, which starts with Slam Bradley. We finally get Slam Bradley into the picture, and it's his perspective. And of course, it starts with, "It was a dark and stormy night.
Oh,
What do
good
you want from
stuff.
me? I'm a detective, not a writer."
It's brilliant stuff. Yes.
And of course, he's in the rain. I mean, of course, the PI part of the story starts with him standing on a rooftop in the rain, but he's not Batman standing boldly and proud in the rain. No, he's like this beaten down gumshoe standing in the rain getting soaked.
Yeah, just disheveled and grizzled. Good stuff. And there's neon behind him.
And of course, I mean, it's just visually amazing. It's just really sets the tone. Of course, Slam is just standing there on the rooftop. We don't know exactly what he's doing on the rooftop yet, because of course we go to flashbacks. But what we find out about Slam is that he's been hired by the mayor of Gotham to investigate the death of Catwoman, because the mayor doesn't believe that Catwoman is dead. The mayor is corrupt as hell because, well, he is a mayor of Gotham. Of course he is. Yeah.
Everyone's corrupt, and they mention that in the very beginning when Selina first gets back to Gotham. It says it shows people paying off the cops, and so it sets the scene that yeah, Gotham's not above board.
But what we're given is to understand that we find out Slam has declined at this point to continue on with the investigation. I wonder if there's a supplement that we find out the full
Yeah.
story here. I guess we'll find out later.
Well, we actually get in the last issue, Selina goes back and Slam walks into his office, and Selina's sitting on the desk saying,
Yeah.
"Hey, I'm here. I heard you were looking for me," which I love as a character moment for Selina. She's not going to try to hide or obfuscate her who she is or where she is. She just goes in and says, "I heard you're looking for me. Here I am. What are you going to do now?"
But it's the classic PI walking into their office and there's a beautiful woman waiting for him.
Yeah, there's the femme fatale in a
Right.
tight dress with her legs crossed on the desk.
Which is great. So within the scene, we also see now that Slam has Frank Falcone hanging off the building, tied up and hanging off the building, while Slam is trying to get information from Falcone about what's going on. So of course we're left a little confused. How does Slam know about all this? What's happening? What's the story here? And this is where we get like the typical PI flashback. Slam has gone to Swifty's to investigate Swifty and Selina and Catwoman and the whole thing. And what he sees is Chantel leaving Swifty's.
He's a good enough detective to know who Chantel is and who she's associated with.
Again, like my notes are like C supplemental because this is all filled in at another point in our podcast. So eventually he tries to follow Chantel initially, but Selena has popped all his tires. And so he sits and lays on top of his car in the rain, ruminating, you know, thinking about things and trying to put pieces together. And this is where he kind of ties Chantel to Frank Falcone. And so he's like, okay, well, I'm going to go to Frank Falcone's. So eventually, through a series of action sequences, he makes his way to Frank Falcone's window, where he witnesses Frank Falcone kill Chantel. And so we go back to the present, where he's on the rooftop with Falcone hanging off the roof, and essentially finds out from Falcone. So Falcone has figured out that Chantel has leaked all the information about the money drop and the heroin, and Falcone finds it out. So Falcone gives a heads up to a Frenchman named Le Perrier,
yes.
To give them a heads up that there is a heist about to happen. So Le Perrier springs into action. Meanwhile, back on the rooftop, Slam finds out about all this information and then just drops Falcone off the roof.
Well, I know, I love this because Falcone says, you know, you said you'd pull me up. And he said, no, I said I wouldn't kill you. I didn't say I would pull you up. And then just drops the rope and lets him hang there, which, of course, is not going to hang there very, very long. You know, he's following the letter of the law, as it were.
The letter of the law, right. But then he walks down off the rooftop and is like ruminating. He's like, well, I need to find a plane. He needs to find a plane to try to track down where this heist is actually going to go down. He gets all the information he needs, knowing that it's going to happen at the U.S. Canada border, but he doesn't know exactly where. Off he goes after dropping Falcone on top of a car. And it's a great, he gets down to the bottom before Falcone drops. And he kind of revels in the fact that he beat Falcone down. So meanwhile, we go back, we go to where the heist is supposed to happen, because this is right before the heist is supposed to go down. And Swifty is with his boat. So Swifty is going to be the boat that picks up Jeff, Stark, and Selena after they drop off the money and then jump into the water from the train. And so Swifty's there with his boat, just kind of waiting on when stuff is supposed to go down. And of course, there's Le Perrier, who captures Swifty and says, hey, how about you and I go out on the boat together and see what is about to happen here?
He has a sparkling personality, by the way. Le Perrier.
It's a little stereotypical of French Canadians, but...
Yeah. Well, it's very... this might be an obscure reference to some. In Twin Peaks, the original series, there were French characters, and they were all like this. Like,
yes.
Yeah. The Jacques Renault and character in Twin Peaks. Like, I am so French because I'm Canadian. Yes, it's stereotypical, but it's also kind of fun.
It is kind of, yeah. Well...
Maybe Canadians don't like it. I don't know. But
yeah,
from a stupid American's perspective, it's kind of fun.
So this issue ends with Slam is on a plane. He found somebody to, like, charter him out to look for wherever this heist is going down. It feels like there's a lot of area to cover. He does know that there should be a train somewhere.
Yeah, and he knows the general area.
And he knows there's going to be a bridge, and because he found all this out from Falcone.
He's also very good. He's a very good detective.
So. He's a very good detective.
Yes, he is.
He is a very, very, very good detective.
Yes. So he detected exactly where to go. he detected like a motherfucker.
And while he's traveling, he gives us like the final clue as to the relationship of Selena and Stark and where it went.
Our first, instead of just oblique references, we get our first actual appearance of Catwoman in this Catwoman comic book.
Right. What happened with Stark and Selena, as referenced before, they agreed to do a heist together. And so, of course, they get the diamonds. So this is all flashback as narrated by Slam Bradley that he found out from reading Selena's file. apparently, according to the eyewitness that saw this, Stark has the diamonds, and the third partner gets shot and killed. Stark runs out. He's waiting for the getaway car. The getaway car isn't there.
The getaway car, which is supposed to be driven by Selina.
Yeah, the third person, which should have been Selina with the car. So he comes out and there's no car there to help rescue him. He's standing there and suddenly a whip comes down, steals the bag of diamonds.
Because that's how whips work.
Yes.
I do like the fact that Stark was left literally holding the bag.
Mm-hmm. The bag man is often left holding the bag.
Exactly.
Of course, looking up, it was, I think it references said, it's only the second or third sighting of this mysterious Catwoman in Gotham, who is the one that stole the diamonds. Stark, instead of shooting at that person, just stands and watches. And thus Stark heads down into the sewers, runs, gets the hell out of Gotham, never to return to Gotham.
Although it's never stated that he knows Selina's Catwoman. He knows Selina's Catwoman.
It's pretty, yeah. Stark is taciturn, but he's not dumb.
Ooh, taciturn. Good word.
Yeah. We all the pieces are in place. We know the history now. We know everything that's leading up to this. We have a ton of flashbacks. We have a lot of planning. We have so many various pieces falling into place. We have a PI on the hunt. We have Stark, Selina, Jeff, and Swifty trying to do the heist. We have LePerrier, who has like weaseled in to sort of screw up the heist. Everything is culminating. We've got a speeding train. We have every possible great setup for a finale. We have all the history we need. Everything is ready for issue 4, which is titled Heist.
Here we go.
And the first like 10-15 pages, which are double spreads,
beautiful stuff,
is Darwin Cook on fire.
It's Darwin Cook just out Darwin cooking himself.
It is visually, I'm not even going to describe what happens. It doesn't matter. You read it.
Yeah. It's basically Selina on the top of a speeding train being badass.
And everything they plan goes off essentially like clockwork with a couple hiccups, but the hiccups don't take long to resolve. This is not how a heist usually goes. There are more problems in a heist. Things go south quickly. No, the heist over 15 double page spreads absolutely works. They get the $24 million. They use their speeding little mini train to hook up with the train. Everything goes right.
Right. There's one point where Selina jumps out the window of the train and Jeff's saying, oh my God, she fell. She's gone. And Stark's like, just relax. She's fine. And then of course she is. Because Selina just uses her athleticism and badassery to get back on the train and get everything, get the money placed in these bags, inflatable bags, which as the train crosses a bridge, they throw the money into the water, which will be picked up.
By Swifty
on a boat. A swift boat, you might say.
A swifty boat.
Swifty boat.
And of course, he's there.
Yep.
The boat is there. The money goes down. They parachute out. Down into the water, there's a humorous bit about Catwoman not liking water, or Selina not liking water, which is, of course, hilarious.
Exactly. Cats don't like the water.
Everything is perfect. They got the money. They climb into the boat, into Swifty's boat, ready to take off into the wild blue yonder with $24 million.
And then the first thing we see is Jeff shot. Boom. And he's down.
Visually, it's so great. I mean, I'm celebrating murder here. it's like flop flop, and so you see like Jeff celebrating. He's lighting a cigarette, and then it's like a half panel. Like you don't see the kill shot. Jeff is lighting a cigarette, and they're celebrating, and he makes some hilarious quip because that's his shtick. And the next panel is half of his head, and you see the cigarette coming out and a spot of blood like splashing off. And then the next panel is Swifty, who has also been shot. That's the two shots.
And at the panel with where Swifty is shot, it's done so well because it's Swifty's face and there's blood coming out of his mouth. And it seems as if he's talking, but it's actually Leperrier standing behind him.
From behind him.
So the speech bubble is actually going behind Swifty. Swifty falls and revealing it's very cinematic. I could totally see this in a movie.
So, boom, LePerrier has taken out half of the crew, and things seem really dire.
Yep, he's about to take out Stark and Selina when
And Deus ex machina.
well, it has been foreshadowed that there is a plane a coming.
And here comes the plane, and
Yes.
suddenly the boat gets dive bombed.
Yeah, it's really great. It's a really great panel of the plane swooping down and just sort of buzzing the boat. There's gunfire everywhere. The plane is being shot at. It's
This is
really
a
great.
movie.
Yeah. There's absolute chaos. There's people on the shore watching this happen.
There's a lot of to do.
There's chaos a-happening.
Right. Selina and Stark fall off, and so we get the plane with Slam and his unnamed pilot landing in the bay, which is where everything was supposed to like come together. They were supposed to land there and do whatever. So meanwhile, so Selina and Stark are off the boat. So Leperrier calls in his compatriot, which we haven't mentioned before, but
They're on the shore, yeah.
they're on the shore. There's another French Canadian guy there waiting for everything to come back his way. So Leperrier left him to figure this out. The plane lands. Leperrier calls in and says, "Hey, take out that plane." And so the lackey shoots up the plane, and of course, the completely innocent pilot is killed, but Slam is missing.
And then LePerrier, trying to escape, is confronted by Stark
Right. So
as
what happens? And this is like a big moment because one of the biggest themes, which I probably should have done earlier, but it's it the this whole series is about trust and mistrust. So what happens is Stark and Selina fell off the boat, and Selina is narrating at this point. Stark actually held on to the rope that's holding the money underneath the boat in the net. And instead of just going on his own, he reaches back and pulls in Selena as well.
he had every opportunity to just let her go,
Right.
but he pulls her
He could have
back
just
in.
climbed up in the boat, taken out LePerrier, and ran off with 24 million. But he saves Selena.
And Stark, once back on the boat, tries to confront LePerrier, who gets the drop on him. And
Flop, 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 flop.
Stark is taken down. And we find Stark in his final moments reveals his real name.
Yeah, and Stark also kills LePerrier at some point. So it's
Yeah, yes, they have a confrontation.
eyes is
LePerrier
up.
kills, yeah. LePerrier kills
They
Stark.
kill
Stark kills LePerrier.
LePerrier.
Yeah, so Stark lays dying and Selina comforts him in his final moments. And Stark, he remembers being a little kid.
Right, and this is really an interesting moment because earlier in the series, Stark says in his internal monologue, he doesn't know his real name. He was raised in foster care.
Go
As he's
ahead.
dying, he remembers something.
He has his mother leaning over his crib, telling him to, just comforting him and calling him Jimmy.
She calls him Jimmy.
So he says to Selina in his final moments, "My name is James," and he
And it, this
dies.
is also it's also important because Stark still thinks he, before all this happens, when he has LePerrier and he's got his gun to LePerrier before LePerrier shoots him, he asks him, "Who betrayed me? Was it Selina and LePerrier or the mob?" And LePerrier is like, "No, I'm an independent actor." This is actually really important, is that Stark was still, up until almost the very end, trying to find out if it was Selina that betrayed him. And it is confirmed by LePerrier that it was not Selina.
His trust was justified.
His trust was justified. And so at the very end, yes, I mean, it's a really touching moment where he's like, "My name is James."
So at the in his final moment, he knows exactly who he is. He finally comes full circle and understands himself right before he dies, which is kind of tragic. But still, we're left with Selena trying to get to shore to get the money to shore, and she is confronted by Slam Bradley.
Slam Bradley, and they chat.
And they do. They have a little chat.
They share some feelings, and there's like it's a very interesting conversation about like morals and ethics. I don't mean to be read too much into a comic book. It is like, Slam's like, I gotta take you in. And Selena's like, hey, Chantel had a daughter and a mother who are suffering. She's like, I've had four people I love die tonight. I'm keeping this money. I am not going to jail. There's the humorous bit where she offers to buy him four new radials for
Exactly.
the items she busted on his car. Slam has a moral center. He's a scuzzy PI who still has a moral center.
His job is to catch the bad guy and take them in. That's
Right.
what he does. And Selena says, "Is you sure there's nothing I can do to change your mind?" And he says, "No." She
He
shoots him.
shoots her. He shoots him.
Which is great. Okay. She looks so defeated too, like, okay. I didn't want to do this, but she shoots him. Doesn't kill him, mind you.
Right.
It's
And
just.
it's very important she doesn't kill him because she likes Slam. And again, there are reasons for this that we haven't gotten to yet. And then, she's like, you're not gonna die. I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna do this. I'm a criminal. You need to understand that if we're gonna have a relationship going forward, and when I say relationship, she's not intimating and intimate, but she's just saying, you'll forget this night ever happened. We will never discuss this again. But she also essentially says, this is who I am. She says, I'm going to make things right with the people who need things made right by.
Yeah, she has a moral code. The lines are blurred, but she has it. She has her own type of morality that she lives by,
Right.
which is completely fitting for Selena Kyle's character. She's always been the bad guy, but she's never been evil.
This ends on like a really sweet slash bittersweet moment. She's walking away back to the boat with all the $24 million, leaving Slam behind. And, Slam is like, Selena, did you love him? She's like, I don't know the meaning of the word. And then we get the lovely last page.
A lovely last page, completely wordless, where she embraces Stark's body and slowly lets him go into the water. She lets him go.
The end.
The end. Absolutely brilliant piece of writing, a gorgeous artwork. Fantastic. No notes. Mwah. Chef's kiss.
Yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
it's every part of this was so perfectly laid in place.
Excellent characterizations, excellent plotting, excellent action. And there's this quiet heart to it, this quiet melancholy that runs through the whole thing.
I mean, it just. Oh, would there have been more of this?
Oh my goodness. I would love, it's one of those could have beens in
Yeah.
comic book history.
So it's like a perfect ending to a comic. It's so well done on every level. But I do want to, I don't want to go into details about the other part of this, but there is another part of this, and this is a 5 to 10 page backup from Detective Comics that kind of ran with this. And this was Brubaker and Cook working together for the first time. It's all about Slam Bradley, and it's all about some of the backup or the behind the scenes stuff that happened here. There's not a lot to add to it, but I do want to say that it is Brubaker and Cook working so masterfully together to fill in the spaces. These 4 issues from Detective Comics, or these four backups from Detective Comics
Yeah, they're just a few
are,
pages each.
they're
Each.
just a few pages each. It basically, they are private eye procedurals with Slam Bradley working through the mystery of Selena Kyle and Catwoman. He slowly figures it out.
It also
And
gives it also fills in the gap because if you're wondering during Selena's story, so where the hell is Batman in all this? Now we know because Batman is around and he is kind of simultaneously, as Slam Bradley is looking for Catwoman, Batman is following Slam Bradley.
Right. It's appropriate because it's Detective Comics, which Greg Rucka, the mighty Greg Rucka, was writing the main story in Detective, and this was just a backup, but it was prelude to Brubaker and Cook taking over. But this is written by Brubaker, it's drawn by Cook, and it's essentially the story of Slam Bradley investigating Selina, and through a whole series of very interesting things, which I recommend checking it out. It would take you 10 minutes to read these backups, is what creates Slam Bradley's interest and affection. I don't think romantic affection, but certainly affection.
Yeah, or admiration.
Or admiration for Selina Kyle in particular and Catwoman. It leads to what was kind of important in all of this is that Slam Bradley decides not to expose Selina Kyle as Catwoman and burns up all of the information that he collected on her.
Yeah, it shows that Slam, even though he has that moral center that we talked about, that, you know, he's the good guy and he has to find the bad guys, in Gotham, those lines are blurred. He realizes that the mayor who had hired him isn't above board either.
Right.
So the right thing to do with, you know, air quotes around it, the right thing is to let her go.
But this is all prelude to the final
yes.
issue of Selina's big score, which leads to why we have sort of that morally conflicted relationship between the two of them.
So it fills in the gaps in a really interesting way.
Yes. No, yeah. It's great comics. It just doesn't necessarily require us to go for another 20 minutes.
So that's it, I think, Brian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So apparently you enjoyed my recommendation.
I did indeed. It is just fantastic. What can be said about Darwin Cook? Has he done any? Has there been a Darwin Cook misstep anywhere in his career? I can't think of one.
I wouldn't wish to speculate.
Yes. just a master at the medium. His art style is unique and gorgeous and unparalleled.
Yeah.
And in this particular story, his obvious love of crime, noir, heist, you know, is on full display. Yeah. And his mastery of the medium it's great. I got nothing else. It's really good.
If you haven't read it, what's wrong with you?
Well, go out and do it now. Do it now. Even if you were spoiled by this, you know, we gave all the spoilers for the story visually. The action scenes and how it is, you know, just the hard-boiled gumshoe talk, the dialogue and the narration.
Just incredible and well-researched. So, yeah,
it's good stuff. Thanks, Brian. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay. You won't be thanking me next week.
Nope, probably not.
So, next time on an all-new edition.
I know spoilers.
Next time on an all-new edition of the Collected Edition, my choice, and I have chosen, for some ungodly reason, to cover Secret Empire, which is the 2017 Marvel crossover event. It's a Captain America-centric storyline that is highly controversial in the Marvel universe. The reason I've chosen...
Why?
Yeah, the reason I've chosen this, it is no secret to anyone who listens to this program. Captain America is my favorite character. And when this had happened, I was pissed. I was one of those fans. I was very upset with what they had done with Captain America and how he was being portrayed. But time has changed. Things have moved on. And I want to revisit this and see if I was justified or if I was completely wrong. We will find out next time. Secret Empire.
Secret Empire.
Hail Hydra.
Hail Hydra.
Okay, so that's it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you haven't read Selina's Big Score, just go get it and read it because it's excellent. We also have a new dedicated Blue Sky account for the Collected Edition.
How exciting.
So go to Blue Sky. We're Collected Pod is our username. I've been slowly adding our back catalog as links and building up our community, the one we used to have on the Twitter face. So it's good. Please come and join us. And I'd love to engage in conversation with you. Other than that, leave a comment on our individual episodes on our website, collectivisionpodcast.com, and come back next time and read Secret Empire. Yeah, so until next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy-O production. All materials used on the program are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. If you'd like to give us your feedback, the show can be found online at our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes, or send us an email to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.